Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. I'm completely knocked off my any balance that I had going into this call. It's now gone after almost half an hour of technical difficulties, which has actually never happened before. So I'm thinking this must be a really important conversation. Just welcome, Jonas Rupia. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really, really happy to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here as well. See where we go, where we get this time.
Exactly. How far? Nobody knows. I've been trying to ask you who you are twice. I don't know if that's the information that I'm not supposed to ask you who you are. But I think I will stick to that paradigm and still ask you, who are you, Jonas Rupe?
Thanks. So this is the third try. Rather than say what I thought I'd say, I'd give you a story instead. So 20 years ago, almost exactly 20 years ago, I'm sitting in my, at that time, big villa with my family, my mom, my two daughters that are 1 and 2.5 years old, and a representative of the Iroquois Nation, or an alliance in my house, and Jan Jenvi, who kind of gathered us in the meeting. And we also had the head of HR of the big company we were working on, and the mom of my children, who was high executive at the same company. And we were supposed to speak about leadership. And Oren, he told us rather quickly that they groomed children from their, you know, from very early age to become leaders. And that grooming continued as long as there was, were an elder. They were continuously refined as people and as leaders, and they could be put aside if they didn't behave, even if they were a high-powered chief. And we quickly realized that we cannot adopt that in a global company. That kind of leadership practice is far beyond what we had, well, the kind of possibilities we had. So after dinner, he went on to talk about the climate crisis, which I couldn't believe, and the ecosystem crisis that were widespread, which I had a hard time to believe that was so bad. At that time, I was head of business intelligence at that company. So I had 500 analysts under my command and were responsible for their for them in many ways. So I was kind of at the height of my arrogance, you could easily say. And then the third thing he said or explained in detail was the global lack of governance of these fundamental questions or existential questions and threats. And I spent a full year trying, in my spare time in the evenings, in the weekends, to prove him wrong. Mm. And I failed miserably at that. And that threw me into several years of inner turmoil, you could easily say. And at one point in time, we had a friend that was a psychologist. My wife, she explained to her that our youngest daughter, I think she was 3 years at that time, she came, she wanted to have stövlar, rain.
Mm-hmm. Wellington, yeah.
Yeah, because the flood were about to come, and you didn't know when. And the psychologist, Anna, she said that you shouldn't talk to your children about things that they have no, they can't do anything with. So she's too young to have that information. And I guess that has been a thing that followed me. How candid can you be about what you do, what you work with, what is coming? The future they are facing is a vastly different future that I was facing when I was young. And I remember as a teenager how upset I was with the older generations. Now, I had one mom that made their excuses for their generation hadn't been able to fix the environmental problems. Mm. And I thought it's kind of such a sad thing to come with excuses. I'm at the same point in time, of course. I'm also part of a generation that failed to fix much of the problems we have. So, and I spent 10 years to find a way to influence on a system level, because after that meeting with Oren, I lost much of the interest in, or all of the interest in, making a career, you know, in a traditional sense, and I put my effort rather than to go in as a strategist or consultant or some kind of leadership capacity for companies that where there was a CEO or management team or owner, but typically a CEO that wanted to do positive change with the core business as a vehicle. I found that it didn't matter much, you know, if it was a privately owned company, if it was a stock owned company, or if it were a company owned by the state. You couldn't change the system anyway. You created another anecdote in a development that took us faster and faster in the wrong direction. And then 10 years ago, I met Pelatil, and we were a few persons that supported her basically to start Endicocide Sweden as an association, but she was basically the brain behind that inception, and later on Ecocide Law Alliance, and we're looking at rights of nature issues now. But so I work with that to some extent, and I still advise corporations typically where there is a CEO or a management team that want to use their core business as a tool for reducing the stress and the threats to societies, and in whatever ways they can reduce the speed of the meta crisis we're throwing ourselves into. A long answer, which I didn't intend to give you from the first time, but that is something about who I am, I guess. So, and I kind of, as an individual, I'm very interested in what people perceive as real and what they don't perceive as real, which is a problem and an opportunity. So I'm interested in magic from that perspective. Close-up magic. I've studied some shamanism, but basically, I've studied it because the what we believe have such a profound impact on what we see and perceive. And if you do close-up magic, you can play around with it a lot, because you could make totally impossible things happening in front of people's eyes, and when they can think how much they want, it is totally impossible, and that is because of flaws in their perception, which is the trap, of course, that we're all into. We're all in a perception trap. So it's a big opportunity, of course, if you're a corporate leader and you can defy orthodoxies in the industry, becoming stronger, a more potent of a force in sustainability, if that's what you want. And afterwards, it perhaps is obvious, or they will never figure it out, depending on how you do it.
Okay. I'm still finding my footing. And that was, it's beautiful. I got curious about both the arrogance and also the flaws in perception. Those are two. And I mean, from the way that I'm phrasing a question around what I'm doing at the moment is around difference. How difference works and what it is to make one, and things like that. Very inspired by Nora Bateson's work and the way that she phrases and kind of circles that problem. But I'm curious about that arrogance, because it sounds like you said you were at peak arrogance, and I think another way of telling it was would have said that you would probably be the incredibly successful, or something like that.
Yeah. I was very successful in what I did. So I had this idea that company should have environment as part of their vision, and I started as the lowest you could be in the company. That was a project manager or a secretary, and I was a project manager. And then 3 years, and straight off university. Hmm. 3 years later, I changed the strategy and rewrote the vision with the CEO. I did that at the same time I was head of strategy and business intelligence at one of the big profitable business units. Hmm. And then a few years later, I met Orion Alliance, and then I was in charge of corporate business intelligence at worldwide. So it was a journey that was tremendously quick. And when I think about it, one thing that I had a big that helped me a lot was I did the transcendental meditation twice a day for 20 minutes a day. So I was incredibly present and incredibly aware of small things and very calm. I was really, I believe, a good support to the management teams I was working with, and could help them to see what they didn't see. But myself, I didn't see the big picture of what we're doing on the planet. And I couldn't believe it was so bad. And I had all these resources at my disposal. And I could do, and I had, and I did, rather big changes in what I did, but it was within a paradigm. And when that kind of dawned upon me, my priorities changed a lot. It's like after an earthquake, you know, your priorities would change a lot. So it was kind of such a moment for me. And I started to ask, and I guess you asked similar questions. I started and realized that I know nothing about what is coming, and I know nothing about how to change it, and I know nothing about what it takes to make the change we need. So I started to ask people, you know, what will happen? When will we change course? Why is the political leadership as it is? Mm. I got a comment that the people need to be in support. So you cannot be a responsible leader if you walk before the people are willing to follow you. So it's a kind of, they are not isolated as leaders. Mm-hmm. I read a lot, and I have great respect actually if you don't want to do it, but I started to hang around with people that had very different worldviews than I had. And what that does to you is that changes you as well. So you cannot listen with, you know, all of your heart and not be changed of what you hear and what people have experienced and their views. So you come out, you know, as a different person yourself. Mm. And a thing that people said at that time, you know, this is 15 or 20 years ago, was that the white middle class Europeans need to suffer a lot before they will change or force the leadership to change. Mm. Since then, we got social media and mobile internet, so that didn't work. So we are kind of in a, you could call it, I guess, catabolic development, where we have crisis, you know, all around us, and it distracts us from doing the most important things first. Mm. Mm-hmm. So I guess I don't feel very arrogant anymore.
I have one more question about the arrogance, and then we can move on. But it's like that arrogance that lived in you, or when Oren told you the stories that he told you, what did it say? What was the defense, or like what were the lines of defense of that arrogance? How was it deflecting or not willing to take? Because I mean, something went in. You took the consequences of something as well. So, but I'm just wondering, like, what was the defenses that came up?
He did a very good job of handling it, I think. But I get one of the things is it doesn't fit at all with what I've seen, what I heard, what those around me have reported, and I had wide range of, how should I say, a widespread network of colleagues and associates and friends. So it came reported something completely different. One thing that is interesting, I guess, is that many times happens to strategists if they go and look into the future and they come too fast back to the management team, and then they report something that is cognitively very different from what the management team reacts as real. So I've noticed that, and I heard it already, you know, at age of 32 or something. But it's quite a different thing so it wasn't, it must be totally wrong. Cannot be this bad. So I think that was it. And then a big question is what will this mean to me? How will life on this street where I live change? How will my relation to those around me change? So you also have, so this kind of a stairway of denial. So it has to be completely wrong. So, okay, perhaps it's not completely wrong, but it's not this bad. It is this bad, but surely there's plans and experts and things in place. Well, and then, okay, it isn't. It's not like that. It's even worse. And then it kind of starts to, you know, what should we do different? And I think that is the most painful, I think, when it comes to this type of question, because the last thing you want to do and the last thing the world needs is false hope and distraction. So if you do something that is good, you know, within the company, that could spark false hope, distraction, and then it looks good. We are shifting to circular economy or something. But that might not at all be the case. So you can have something that isn't greenwash. It's really truthful, you know, full-hearted, but it does no difference. And that's really painful. So it's kind of, but so I think that, so denial from that perspective was easy. And the lines of defense is this cannot be true. And then also a worse form of kind of defense is, I guess I struggle with it sometimes still, is that I'm so well learned, I'm so well educated, I know this system, I know business so well, I know how the economy works in Western Europe and the global, you know, to some extent, and I know psychology, I've studied it, I know engineering, and so what could a history professor from North America that, you know, comes, how could he be so, come to so different conclusions than me? I guess I struggle with it sometimes still when you have people, I mean, for instance, you know, educating people in circular economy, and then they come with very naive questions. And well, I've transformed several companies to circular state, but still, I'm not, you know, I'm more wrong than right still. So, and also something I know, but it's kind of hard, I think, is typically people without all that education, without all that training, and without all that experience that come with the real profound things. But it's kind of, you have your filter of arrogance, and I guess personality, the answer of who you are, comes in the way of it. And I've seen it many times, and still, you know, I struggle with it, and, you know, bite my tongue, you know, with my self-beating.
It's so interesting. I'm hearing you speak to maybe like three stories, or I mean, I call them stories, but they're more like sentences, but they're so like prevalent in the system today. And it's like one was like something around sort of this, that's not how the world is, or that is how the world is, like that type of story. And then the other one would be something like, what's in it for me? And like how we keep telling those stories in marketing and whatnot. And then you can't sell, everybody knows that you can't sell anything unless it's in, like, you know, everybody knows that, right? Isn't that? And then the third part is around the knowing that I was hearing you speak to. It's very, that how knowing and how grasping or knowing something is, seem, you know, it's like that. That's the definition that we have of knowable almost in our sort of very cognitively focused and biased world. We think that we need to think our way through things, and that is the only way that we can kind of be with it or know it. And in a way, it ties into your magic, right? That this is the magic trick, like the this is where the perception tricks us.
Yes, it does. So, which is embarrassing, of course, because what I'm intrigued by is also areas I suck at. So there's this kind of story or meditation fabulous in Buddhism, where everyone on the planet is enlightened, but they pretend not to be. And then they make you, you know, educate them, you know, what is enlightenment, so that, you know, so that even you in your dense state will listen and learn. So it's like that, but it's, it was beautifully summarized. So how the world works, what's in it for me, and the knowing and being in another part or state of knowing. What do you think is the least discussed of these traps?
My perception, or from where I'm sitting and seeing the world, it's the knowing. How deep the deception goes, both culturally and individually, if there is such a thing, which I doubt strongly that there is. But that's part of what I'm coming awake to, is my own arrogance. So that's why I was also asking about that, of course. That I think that I know, and I continuously move between islands of knowing. And I do a lot of thinking that I know more than others. And there's judgment there. So it's how did you move from the new realization that you made, like this new world that started to emerge as you dug into it, and that led you to find Pella and this. Yeah, I mean this reality that your daughter wanted Wellingtons to stave off the flood, or I mean, what's been a constructive way for you to start beginning to move or grapple or wrestle with this new reality?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think my method. I didn't think about it as a method, was action. So I was looking then for meaningful things to do. My family found a summer house in the island of Gotland. And when we came there, we noticed there was a fight about the water in the ground. So Gotland is like the Greek islands, it's full of calcium, and there was these companies that wanted to extract calcium. And first you need to cut down all the trees, and then you dug very, very deep pits to cut it out. And then you upset the groundwater, and it was in a bad state. So I got engaged in that with the policy and with the strategy of that movement. And it was very, very successful. So through doing things in practical, it lessens your sense of despair, and it brings you to people that are also very interesting people, So you get a sense of community. And when, so I had this meeting with Pella saying that we have all this knowledge with how can we change, or how can we help you with your ecocide question? And then she had this conversation, which was a bit like the Orange Lion conversation with me. So, and she kind of reminded me how bad the state of the world is. No, it's much worse than you kind of still believe, Jonas. And I realized also that she had that thing. This is 10 years later. She had that thing that that could make a dent in the development in the past and open up things in a very nice and peaceful ways, but powerful ways. So it has been through action, and that has been kind of for me a tough lesson. I'm kind of rather an introvert person. I have extrovert capacities, but they consume a lot of energy for me. So I kind of prefer not to be on stage because I guess from my upbringing it was tough, and also spending a lot of time in the woods rather than with, I had no classmates in the neighborhood. So I'm kind of, it takes a lot of energy. So but I've been kind of nudged and pushed into situations where I do, you know, hold lectures and have presentation and do leadership and take responsibility for having things really happening in ways that that has been challenging for me, I think. But it is it's really good. It's really good. And many times you have strengths that you don't believe you have until you're forced to kind of test them.
Mm.
Yeah, I think kind of. I read a lot of Buddhism, you know, early on. It's, you know, relative, of course, but they have this notion. We probably spoke about it, I think, when we had our phone call a few weeks ago. But the Buddha Dharma Sangha, which is an answer on where do you take your refuge?
Mm.
Well, you have an environment which is crazy and where that goes against everything you believe and perhaps everything you hold sacred. So Buddha is someone that has gone the path before you. It doesn't have to be a spiritual leader, but it could be a person that have done things that are similar or have similarities. And you can, so for instance, we have Birgitta Dahl in Sweden, which led the, among other things, the legislation against beating up children. So when she came with that, it was considered, you know, a nice Swedish tradition to beat up your family if they didn't behave. That was what she was told. And 90% of kindergarten children were beat, you know, had were beaten up regularly at home. And then after legislation, 10% are being beaten up. So it's an improvement, of course. So that would be Buddha. And then Dharma is that you rest on your reality. And I thought that meant that you find your inner mountain and you know, find your essence. So that's why I meditated a lot to find it. It's really difficult to find it through meditation, though. But I realized, you know, when you ask me, it means, I think, at least as much doing things in practice. You know, grounding yourself in action.
Mm.
That is a refuge. I actually haven't put that into. And then the last thing which you get is Dharma. So when you do action, the Dharma is a community of persons who remind you about what is sacred, what is important, where you can, you know, rest with the Dharma Sangha. So action is definitely a refuge in crazy times.
This might be an interpretation on my end that goes too far, but then please correct me. But there's something around how you spoke of action that, because there's another story, especially in sort of the regenerative or well, not maybe, but particularly sustainability and circular economy circles, where I feel there's almost like a despair in the action. There's almost like this sort of shrill voice saying, like, we have to do something. And there's something in what you were saying now that doesn't resonate like that for me. You said meaningful things to do that lessen the despair, but that also it's like it's in the doing itself. So it doesn't necessarily matter if you have to deviate from the plan. If you discover while you're doing that the plan was wrong, then the doing takes precedence or something like that. It's like a, I don't know, I'm just perceiving a nuance shift in, it's not doing anything, whatever the cost. It is, there's a different intentionality or centeredness or essence in your doing, perhaps.
No, you're right. No, that's you're right. I think personally, we will not be able to solve today's problems for coming generations. So all future generations will suffer for a lot of problems that we failed or still failing to solve. Science is really clear that we are looking at 5 tipping points possible, you know, being trespassed within less than 10 years. And they may already be triggered. So I think the responsible position is not only to lessen the damage that we're doing and trying to doing what you can to reduce the speed to start with. Mm-hmm. But it's also to do what you can to soften the blow or create a local soft landing, at least, or regional soft landing. So you need to think about resilience to be responsible. And I think it depends on where you are in your life, but if you work in business, there's a lot of things you can do in your business that softens and improves conditions for the societies where you operate. And that is a broadening of you could almost say it's a dissolvement of the concept of sustainability. It becomes much more something else that is less easy to box in. So it's on a kind of a energetic level, it also means a letting go of outcomes and letting in what you can do for the people around you in the societies you operate in now and in the future. And so I kind of think about the path ahead as three phases. So we have protecting wise decision in the now, so that we don't do rash things that makes things worse. So triage is kind of a term that some people use, which is kind of first aid. So what do you need to protect? If the worst scenarios, one or some of the worst scenarios come in, so you might want to protect the quality of your water. So reducing the chemicals. And in Sweden, we have very polluted waters that are drinking water for people already. Food resilience, really important. And energy of some sorts. And communication is another one. And in Sweden, we have sold out ownership of many of the communication networks, infrastructures. So it's kind of a troublesome position. So one thing is that, and you have the economy and how it works and where the assets are. So there are many things like, what do you need to protect? And I find that a lot of people that work with sustainability and future questions, for decades, they haven't asked themselves that question. And if they have, it's typically like a prepper thing, which is useless. So prepper is useless. You need to do things on community level. And then you have the transition, the things that will be a guiding path or a guardrail into something that is actually in concert with the conditions of life on the planet. So you could do things in a time capsule and send it into the future if you like that. But you could also think about this, the things that creates a local soft landing that is really meaningful, or the things that will help us to transition, and then what will what lessons and what kind of assets and capacities will be needed in the future for the coming generations. So that is kind of practical thing to think about it and strategize about it. But on an energetic level, it's a release. You know, you release yourself from the must. We must protect the global growth. We must protect this and that. And that's kind of trying to protect it when it's kind of I shouldn't say everything is contributing, but there's so many problems with how we constructed the society and the blindness of it, the lack of feedback. That's so it's kind of a release, and it makes it possible to be much more practical in what you do with your time. I think a lot of people, when they kind of go into looking wider and longer, you could do it over lunch, looking wider and longer, and then they can find a release. That things that they, it's kind of a little bit, I think, like when you go, you got a burnout syndrome, which I got, I guess, 7 years ago or something like that. I couldn't operate for a month. Took me a year, I think, to get out of it. But I can now almost, I could feel it. I had this, it felt like the things that I had to do evaporated out of my body. And I kind of got a new orientation, which was to protect my body first and my capacity to be still on the planet, number one, and then care for the family, and then do everything else, you know, as good as I could with the energy that I had left. And then for about a year, there were no energy left to do things for the world. It was kind of fully occupying just to make sure my children got their lunch and dinner and had someone to talk with. But I couldn't fill in papers even, you know, in the beginning. So, and I think for the, you know, looking at it as an adult, for functionally well-functioning adult, you know, on the world, I think it's similar. You know, releasing yourself from all the musts helps you to kind of have a fresh look.
Yeah, but there's, I mean, this is something around sort of when you're saying that, I'm hearing sort of the cultural response around sort of, but you cannot. If you just care for your family and you just do the things at home and you only care for your locality, then, you know, how dare you? That's so selfish. Like it's that type of, I'm not saying that, but there's a tone of that story that we've been taught, at least that I've been brought up in, that I cannot care for myself because that's selfish. I cannot care for the ones that are closest to me and love, and I cannot engage myself in my community. And, it's actually, I went to a conference called the Local Futures Conference, and going there, my wife, she had engaged herself as a class parent in the kids' school. And as I was boarding the flight, and I was kind of annoyed, I was like, oh God, like, why do we have to do this thing? And like, oh my God, and like, oh, it's so annoying. It's going to take so much time and it's going to be blah, blah, blah. And then at the conference, I had a lot of people speak about local futures and localization and resilience and then coming back, my wife was kind of expecting me to still be in that mood. And then I was like, no, let's do this. We should do this. I'm going to get on the school board and let's really get involved locally. Like, this is what it's all about. But I really had a profound realization that it is actually what it's all about. Like, it is about the place where we're at. And if we cannot sort of work with the people that we know the names of, and know their families and know all their circumstances, to dare to propose them to do something differently, then who am I to call myself a change agent somewhere else? Like,
Yeah, that can be tough, but it is very true. It's very true.
There was something that you've been saying a couple of times now, in connection with like lessen the damage, and then you've been saying reduce speed, slow down.
Yes.
Do you want to say something more about that?
So I'm trying to sort it out a little. So, yeah, we could take this different route, different ways. So I'll take it more the controversial route, I guess. A lot of local communities, they could be faced with the word not in my backyard, NIMB, not in my backyard. So you have an extractive thing going on and they should just move away. And if you have a mining companies, even in Sweden, they could say that you should be grateful we're so polite. We could just send you by mail explosives and you could blow up your own house. I've actually been told that. So that happens all over the planet. A reason for it happening is that we're so extremely wasteful with our resources, and it's invisible to us, the damage. So if we only would use things, you know, twice or three times, we would have such much. We might actually be well within the planetary boundaries if we discontinue to pollute and lay waste as well. But 70% of the greenhouse gases, for instance, is connected to material use, material extraction and refinement. And we're so very, very wasteful. So reducing the damage is, you know, doing things a little bit better. Problem is that the reward system is better the more wasteful you are. So we need to change a lot of laws locally and internationally. And so a quick fix then is to have a super law that addresses the worst things, and that would change permission then to make a more fine mesh network of adapting local laws or national laws. So reducing the damage is being smarter. Interestingly enough, in circular economy, there is waste where you could actually become more profitable fast by not being so wasteful. So that is part of lessening the damage. But I think it's also, you know, important that local communities activate themselves, and you know, because it will be harder and harder to find another place to move that is not polluted. And also, if you move, you lose your contacts. You know, you have to go into a new community. In the US, they have this word sacrifice zones. So you pinpoint extraction where the local communities are disorganized or not so well educated, so that they will offer little resistance. So lessen the damage has to do with that. Mm. And the machine, if we aren't kind of changing its direction or lessening the damage, it will, you know, continue to eat this life on the planet faster and faster until there's nothing left. So that is the trajectory. Mm. And that is why we need things like ecocide law that gently shifts direction into a less damaging path. And then reducing speed. I think, I don't think ecocide law will do that. I think it will shift the direction, not the speed. I think the speed will continue to pick up, but hopefully not the destructive speed, and certainly not the most destructive aspects of it. But reducing speed, I think, is very important for us as individuals. It would be good if we could reduce the speed of economic activity. I haven't seen anything, I believe, but I'm sure I'm missing a lot that will actually reduce the speed of it until, you know, that is gentle and not, you know, upsetting a lot of other things like creating more wars and stuff. But I think reducing speed is very, very important for us as individuals, because only then can we be wiser. And only then can we reorient, and only then can we listen to each other to complement our faulty perception. Mm. And only then can we cherish, you say in English, the life we've been, you know, awarded as coming here and sharing that with those that we love. I think for me, it's definitely like that. I wish I had done less good and spent more time with my children. and less of everything, I think. And one of the things I've been saying is we do as good as we can, but half would be enough. We beat ourselves. Not only that we're going to almost, you know, drive ourselves to extinction, you know, killing ourselves in the, because we're so panicked. We could be so panicked. On top of that, we beat ourselves up because we don't do enough. You know, it's kind of, we wouldn't do that to anyone else, I don't think. So we should reduce the speed, I think, but it would be, I hope, some smarter than me or wiser or both will find very quickly ways to reduce the speed of the economy in ways that don't create more problems.
Mm.
And that is a long-term fix. That would be good.
Yeah. And then I was listening to Dennis Schmachtenberger, who is this, you know him. Mm-hmm. But he was saying that at some point, something like to the extent he was doing his spiel about the meta crisis and the whole thing in like the 12,000 year timeline, just beautifully laid out, and it's just perfect. And you really see how all these pieces fit together. And then he said something to the extent of like, yeah, the one thing that we could do that would be the most sort of that give us the most benefit, or that would actually really make a dent, is for us to stop doing. Like, yeah. Yes. But that's not going to happen. So, and then there were like all these, but it's, yeah, just makes me laugh about the simplicity and like as you're, how we're chasing our tail into this thing and we keep on top of it, keep beating ourselves up for not being whatever we think that we're supposed to be, you know, instead of.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I had something like a dream. Not quite sure I would call it a dream. The other night, not the night that led into yesterday, where you had two aliens, you know, one alien coming here in disguise and then looking, you know, gathering information and going back and then saying, well, on planet Earth, they have these big telescopes looking for us. We should continue to hide. And this is what they're doing to their water, their soil, to all the other animals, to themselves. This is how they're constructed. And on top of it, they reward themselves the most and celebrate the richest people that are most destructive.
Mm.
We should never let them find us. So it's kind of total fantasy, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so depressed, so I couldn't sleep for 2 hours. And then my partner eventually noticed that I was awake, couldn't sleep, 2 a.m. So she gave me a hug until I fell asleep.
Mm.
I was so depressed about, you know, what we're doing. And we're doing it to ourselves. And then on top of it, we're hurrying so we kind of steal our own very lives from ourselves. So slowing down. It's an act of rebellion in itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the good thing with it, I have this friend, he is a guard at one of the, you know, high security prisons in Sweden. Used to be a UN, used to be a military, incredibly kind person. He says, if you want to be happy, you should look carefully at what everyone else do. And then you do the exactly the opposite. The good thing, you know, with, you know, having this small, on personal level at least, acts of rebellion against the craziness of our time is that you become more happy. You, and you become more resilient. So it's not, but I think you need to have the sadness. And I think one more thing, that we speak too little with each other about the pain we need to go through to come out on the other side. And I guess sometimes this other night, really needed that long, long hug. But, you know, in one way or another, we need hands to hold on as we, you know, go through it. And it could be over lunch. It could be in a retreat, but I think it could be, as powerfully just over lunch or a walk. And like you are, with this podcast, and I think wherever you are, opening up for conversations that are real.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole person can be part.
Yeah, I think. And I mean, the pain is always, it's also tricky in terms of that magic trick that you were talking about, like the magic, the way that you look at sort of the perception of pain. Because I have this, it's like one of my stories, the defining stories actually, that I was skiing and then I broke a leg. So like it went, so, it didn't go well. And then, so they were taking me down the mountain, and then there was this question of like, well, do you want a sedative now, or do you want it? But if we give you something now, we might not be able to put you under and operate on you later. And I said, saying like, no, I'd rather that you operate now and piece me together, because I think waiting, I don't like the idea of waiting longer with a broken leg, because of I'd rather that you put it where it should go, because I think as far as I know that would be better. And then I had this sort of ride in an ambulance in Norway down towards the hospital. And I had this sort of extraordinary experience of really being very, very present with the pain. And just to feel how the body was working with it. Like, because the pain was, of course, it was excruciating. It was consuming my entire attention at times. But at times, there was also calm. And at other times, there was sort of a surge of just neurochemistry, like just chemicals that through my body that was like completely taking me away. Like when you got the adrenaline and the pulse comes up, and like I got the attention and I kind of tuned in, and like I was aware and hyper aware even of. And so, at the end of that trip, the nurse who was in the ambulance, he was saying, he's like, I don't think your leg is broken, really. You should be in more pain. And I said, oh, it's absolutely for sure broken. I know it's broken. Like you can see it. And then they got me off the stretcher and then into the thing and then onto an X-ray, and both of the sort of bones in that one leg was completely sheared off and so forth. And he was like, yeah, okay. Like, good job. But there's so much, I think, that we don't know about pain as well. There's more to it there. Like there's so much information in the pain, and there's so much aliveness in the pain as well. So that there is a way of but I'm hearing you speak to that, but there's just something around, I wanted to tell that story just in relationship to pain, that there's magic there too. There are other ways of relating with it that changes it or transmutes it or something like that.
Yes. Yes. No, very important. Very, very important. I have a book here somewhere from Thomas Bjurkman and Lena Andersen. They studied the Nordic secret. And the most powerful thing for me was they talk about the folkbildning that happened in Denmark and Sweden about 100 years ago, where they figured out that for democracy to work, people need to be have evolved as humans to a certain standard. And so they trained people, had a kind of a scheme where without, not like some kind of development goals where you have a hierarchy, but they kind of had this idea that you first need to be a physical human and then a social human, and then after that, an aesthetic human.
Mm.
So you wouldn't, as I did, I got training in marketing and sales and advertisement and stuff without having the moral training in the university. But I think so, understanding and being able to handle the adrenaline and all the feelings, identifying them, I learned from Brené Brown that the average person can only identify three feelings that is while they feel it, which is anger, happiness, and being pissed off. And then, of course, that's a big disadvantage in relations where you have feelings, thousands of variants of feelings that overwhelms you. and you cannot speak about it, and you cannot sort it out together either. And you probably get a wrong idea of why that happened, because you cannot, cannot sort it out. So I think it's really important then to be able to handle, starting with the physical, physical emotions. And I think it touches upon this, every one of us have to live with fear, a fear of physical pain, our mortality, bad things happening us. And then when it happens to a loved one, like a child or children or a spouse, you're a poor support if you cannot calm yourself and hold them while they experience pain or fear. So it's really fundamental, I think. And also kind of paradoxically, as everything that's interesting, I think that when you have some capacity, it kind of releases you. The fear is lessened and the agency is increased. Very good example.
I'm thinking we maybe want to start rounding off. I don't want to really, but I think it might be a responsible thing to do.
I'm looking. I had the string here somewhere. I thought I'd show you, but I cannot find it. So when we meet physically, I have this fantastic magic trick with a string. I wonder where it went. So we'll have to round up with words, perhaps.
Is there something that you want to have said in this context?
I have a question for you, I think. So for I'm and I could I think I'll just ask for my own sake. So you've been around looking and listening and speaking with a lot of people for quite some time now, and for someone that struggles. I'm still struggling, I think, being on this planet as a human. How can I do that well? Where do you find your inspiration and thoughts of, how to cope?
Actually, you summed it up really well in what you spoke, those three steps, that I have a strong resonance with that. And I hadn't really seen it in that clear way, but I do things that I find are meaningful. And a lot of that has been to override my inner critic saying that it's pointless or it doesn't really matter but I kind of follow the stuff that makes me feel good. So that's how I've oriented towards meaningful action and trying to make sure that I'm not hurting anybody and that I can't, if I can see hurt, if I can see stress or like on whatever level, I try to stop or change or modify. But that's my heuristic. And that has led me to community. I have wonderful people all over the world now that I feel like we're in the same canoe or boat or walking on the same path or something like that. And that has allowed me to let go. Like I'm not going anywhere anymore. I'm not striving for something specific for myself anymore, but I want to be engaged and I want to do things that put lives at the center. So those three steps that I heard you speak to were a very, very deep resonance for me. And that's how I feel like I operate. And then I just kind of set my bar at being okay. And by doing that, I can kind of balance between the economic and the worldly requirements and also the more the other stuff. But it has allowed me to be a present dad, for instance, which I refused to allow myself for the first 5 years of my kid's life, for instance, so forth. I was really beating myself up as soon as I was present, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't let go of the musts of things, but I can now sometimes. So I'm, yeah.
Thanks for, yeah. I guess there's so many balancing acts we do. And one really big one is to be present as a dad and available as a dad. And doing everything you can to protect their and every other living being's future. You know, and then regardless of where you put your balancing act on that scale and all other scales you kind of touched upon, you're probably beating yourself up, or it's easy to beat yourself up because you weren't present enough, or you were too much at home and participated too little in the whatever demonstration or project. And I guess we have to, and my dad used to say that you need to be kind to yourself.
Mm.
Kind of one of the few advices, and he had two. The other one was, don't be surprised about your fellow humans; they're all crazy. Was his two advices to me. But I think, yeah, we need to be kinder to ourselves and each other. Yes, you very good, important reminder for me as well. Thanks.
I'm curious about. Maybe this is actually a last question, but that, as you said, balancing act, something sparked in me. And I have this inquiry at the moment where I'm looking at sort of this, the one way I'm saying, like, I'm not going to compromise on anything. I'm just going to do my thing. I know how the world works, and I believe in energy, and I believe in ghosts, and I believe in all these things, like these crazy things, you know? And so that's just how I'm going to act in the world. And so that's like one way for me to kind of escape or like make myself irrelevant. In a way, and it's liberating, because then I'm out, you know. And then on the other end, there are all these ways of saying, like, no, the world has to be this way, and I need to structure, and we have to do the same stories, and we can't change too much, like to keep the metrics of the current world going or something like that, so that we stay in the, or like become rigid in what we believe in or something like that. And I feel like you have a softness to and curiosity to the way you seem to be moving. I mean, we don't know each other super well yet, but I somehow feel a strong kinship with how you are in the world, how I perceive you in the world. How do you, it was there before as well, but it's like, how do you maintain that? Or like, what are the, is there an one important, or like a several important things, like other than what's come up that you would point to?
Oh, that's a good, okay. What comes up for me is, perhaps I need, I'll say it because it comes up, and then perhaps I'll try to answer more directly if I figure it out. But one thing is, you have transcendence, that you kind of want to do all the meditation and all the spiritual practices of your favorite, and then leave these bodily sensations. And the other aspect, you know, other end of that spectrum is immanence. That you find grace and beauty and divinity even in the smaller things, in water drops or in the feeling of sweat on your skin or thing, like immanence. And you're fully, fully present. And I think of it like my dad, or our collective dad is spirit and our collective mother is earth. And we're both the feminine and the masculine, and it's kind of and it's liberating not to be, you know, but also because of the state of the planet, we're kind of poisoning the sky by digging up things we shouldn't dig up. So I have a kind of I'm rather fluid when it comes to that, and I also after my burnout, I kind of lost a lot of interest in studying spirituality. I did a lot before. I'm much more interested in the practical things.
Mm.
And that is kind of a release as well. But I think it's important. It is an escape to be going into the transcendent state, especially when we're kind of. So that's one. And also, I kind of came across that for a long time ago, that we are supposed to use our mental capacities like a dance. So you go into, and I've noticed that I work with problems a lot like that. So I kind of go into a problem. This is, you know, where I think is the kind of problem. And then I release it. Mm. And then my subconscious comes to my aid, over perhaps 2 days. And sometimes the phone rings in uncanny ways, and I got the answer over the phone or, you know, in a random meeting. So I can now have a you know, a dance-like approach to cracking tough issues. And what I particularly do is I kind of insert time. So I know I intellectually could crack something perhaps in 30 minutes, but I'd rather have 2.5 days. So then I try to crack it and perhaps crack it. And then, you know, 2 days later, I have a refined version of it. So when it frees up space, and it also means I can do other things while I kind of figure out, you know, something about. So I'm kind of into a lot of, I have a lot of thoughts about financing things, you know, how to funnel financing. And that's also something that is nice to do very, very slowly, because consider it and, you know, try back and forth. So I have, and I think, I don't know what you think, but is it to go too far to regard entire life as a dance?
No, not in my book.
You cannot have your mind too much in control, right? I don't know. I don't have a clear answer, I guess. I'm fooling around.
Appreciate it. Appreciate the fooling around. If people want to find you, or if you want to be found, where should they where can they look?
They reach out. So I am on LinkedIn, Jonas Rupia. I think there are 2 or 3 with my name in the world, so I'm easily found in LinkedIn.
Put a link, clickable link.
And I have a mail address, which is jonas.rupe.org, which is an easy way to get to me. And so if you want to get in contact with me, just pop me a mail or send me a LinkedIn invite. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming and taking the time and dealing with the technical issues and all of that stuff. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. It perhaps was good for us to be off balance.
Yep, that's a good place to start dancing from, I think.
and practicing from. Exactly.